Okay, well, it's great to be here this evening with everybody. What we're going to do is, like was just mentioned, we're going to have a brief discussion, a little bit of an overview of ECT, and perhaps even an update with some details about a little bit about the science of ECT and what's going on in the field with our treatment. Also in attendance is Dr. Shamsuddin, one of my ECT colleagues, who's one of our adult psychiatrists, but also is a child psychiatrist as well. And one of the things that we have a lot of expertise in is managing patients that are younger that require ECT, that patients who have been really sick for various neuropsychiatric reasons. Could be depression, and there's other issues involved that that may lead us to choose ECT as an option for treatment. So, but I have about 20 slides, going to be kind of a quick overview so we can spend most of the time, obviously, with answering folks' questions and doing the education from in that way. So first, I'd like to kind of just give you a brief overview of what ECT is. And what ECT is, it's a very controlled procedure under anesthesia. Patients are asleep and muscles are relaxed. I recently did a radio interview with Cynthia Canty on NPR here locally for WUOM, and the focus of that brief interview was about stigma and ECT. And when you watch TV and movies, you often see shaking and violent convulsions and things, but that's not the way ECT is actually done. And I actually don't watch these shows or movies because it's just not realistic, and it does us a disservice. And what we're doing is we're applying some electrodes to the scalp, which induces a brief seizure, and the brief seizure lasts about 25 to 60 seconds typically. And there, like I said, there's no dramatic violent convulsions that you might see in TV or movies. The other thing too is that this seizure has a lot of biologic, effects, and that this is a whole lecture in and of itself. But suffice to say that there's a lot of neurotransmitters that are affected when we are doing the seizure treatment, and it could affect a lot of the same kind of neurotransmitters that medications affect, and that includes serotonin, norepinephrine, dopamine. Those are some of the common things that the medications that people take for depression might enhance in transmission in the brain. Depression also is a high stress state for the body and the brain, and a lot of your stress hormones and hormones that control your metabolism and sleep and appetite and all these things, they're controlled by deep centers in the brain, and ECT can help reset some of these stress hormones that get out of kilter with how they're regulated in the body. And so there are certain stress hormones that get sort of stuck on, and ECT can help reset that normal flow and ebb and flow of hormones that are in our bodies. Quite often, people think, well, gosh, you're doing something damaging to the brain, but in fact, there's different lines of evidence to suggest that there's actual nerve sprouting with ECT seizures in different models, scientific or study models. Another effect is sleep. So quite often when people are extremely depressed, they might be really agitated, not sleeping. And insomnia is a huge problem with depression. And even after a couple of treatments, we can see a biologic effects of sleep restoration that's enhanced. So when we do ECT, here's how we normally track things. Patients require about 6 to 12 treatments for the typical depression course. It's going to be variable. This is just a ballpark. This is not a set range. Sometimes more, sometimes few. I've had some patients where they can respond very quickly to two or three treatments even, but sometimes if a person's been really sick for a long time, very resistant to medications, it may take 12 to 20 in certain situations. And there's other psychiatric conditions too that this number 12 might be a little bit on the shorter side, and we may have to go a little bit longer. But it's normally two or three times a week treatment. And at U of M especially, and in a lot of other places, we track depression rating scales. So we actually are gathering data. We know how people are doing, And we're also monitoring this mini mental status examination or other memory tests that we do each week to make sure we're tracking how well a person's tolerating any of the memory side effects. So what I wanted to cover too briefly right away is just to talk about the memory side effects. And this is the typical kind of scenario that might play out with the memory side effects. So when I do consultations for patients, what I usually am spending an hour and a half to 2 hours with patients and families, and a big portion of the time is about educating patients and families about ECT, and a lot of their concerns center around this, the next topic here, which is the memory side effects. And this is essentially the typical scenario. And so when you have ECT and you're having a series of treatments, you might have what we call this anterior grade, amnesia, side effects or memory problems. And what it is where you're having difficulty remembering new information. So remembering a shopping list or remembering, if you're reading an article on the sports page and trying to tell somebody about it later in the day, you might have a tough time holding on to new information. And so it tends to be worse with a different type of treatment called bilateral treatment, and we'll show you the different strategies on how we stimulate the brain. But it tends to resolve. So when a patient is done with their ECT treatments, this short-term memory side effect tends to resolve pretty quickly within a few weeks. Sometimes older patients might take a little bit longer, a few months. If the short-term memory issues are persisting, I have to be very aware that it could be something else. It could be the depression's coming back. Could be the memory, the depression's causing memory problems. It could be if it's an older patient, there could be an early dementia picture in play. So we have to be watchful for those things, especially if it persists for a number of months afterwards. But that's what I was mentioning here, that for some people and sometimes older folks that are maybe in their 70s, 80s may have a little bit slower recovery. The treatment side effects that I tell patients that could be permanent are this retrograde amnesia, retrograde difficulties. And the typical situation is where you have the last memories in or the first out. So I usually discuss with patients when we're talking about starting a course of treatment that whatever was happening in the few weeks to few months is going to be the denser part of the memory, the potential memory loss. And so I tend to use things like the holidays. So if a patient, has ECT in, late September, we might say, in the last month or two, the things you did recently, such as, a Labor Day weekend, if you took a trip somewhere, you could have some spotty memory loss for things that happened in recent weeks, or it could be pretty dense where close to the treatments, you might have some forgetfulness. And some of that could come back and some of it may not. And I let people know that it could go back, 3 to 6 months is a typical type of thing. When patients are really depressed too, your cognitive function or your memory function isn't very, may not be very good, and you may not be laying down good memories, on top of any effects that the ECT might have. But in this is a typical thing. But it's going to be a rare situation where somebody has, really severe remote memories, that are very far back that may be lost. I'm not going to say this may never, ever happen because certain patients where the illness is so bad and so difficult to treat that they might require multiple courses of treatments over a handful of years. They might require maintenance treatments to keep this bad depression at bay. And there could be spotty memory loss for things that are sort of outside this window. Okay. And then the other kind of things that we have to contend with ECT is some of the things that might go along with, any sort of anesthesia type of procedure where you might have some headache or some upset stomach or some muscle aches that occurs with some of the anesthetic agents that we have. And we readily, we can readily fix those kinds of problems typically. And for outpatient treatment, we do at this point, in healthcare, a lot of treatments and surgeries and procedures are done as an outpatient, and the bulk of our treatments now are outpatient, essentially starting around 2000. We do about 60% of our treatments, 70% of our treatments are now outpatient. But a maintenance course, a typical kind of thing for a maintenance treatment is when a person's had a relapse and their depression wants to come back and it won't stay away, what we end up doing sometimes is doing a taper after I get a person's mood better, and we might do a once-a-week treatment, once every 2 weeks, and we kind of chip away until we get to the fewest treatments needed or the least frequent number, the smallest frequency of treatments. And there are some patients, though, that, you know, what we're trying to do, again, is try to prevent relapse. And we do have some folks that it may be that their depression wants to come back and they've had two or three episodes in a year or two. And the best thing to do is combine the medications with, even an ongoing maintenance course where a person might come back every 3 to 4 weeks, and they might do that for an extended time, sometimes 6 months, sometimes a year. So let me give you a brief overview of the history of ECT and where this whole thing came from. So ECT at this point is about 80 years old. I think I kept this slide, but prior to these Italian physicians in 1938, there was a Hungarian physician that published an initial case of using a medication to induce a seizure. And this person was in a state hospital in Hungary that was treated, and he had a series of seizures that was induced by medication injections, and the medication was camphor. And this treatment really wasn't a very good treatment in that when you would inject this medication, sometimes you'd have a seizure, sometimes you wouldn't, sometimes the patient would just be nauseous. And so it wasn't a very controlled way of trying to induce this seizure. And so the Italian physicians, these gentlemen, Cerletti and Binney, developed the first ECT device that was used. And they treated a patient who had really severe psychosis and mania in Rome. And that was essentially what we would say is the birth of convulsive therapy in 1938. And so, again, we're approaching about 80 years. And so in a lot of ways, you know, you could think of it as a technological advancement. You know, you're using equipment, you're using something that's very well controlled to induce the seizure versus some medication that might not actually work. And so I kind of think of it as, there's a lot of stigma about ECT, and we could talk about that too when there's questions. But when you think about the use of electricity and other healthcare problems or health problems such as cardiac problems, a defibrillator, nobody scoffs at that per se as a treatment. But clearly those electrical devices are needed to really help medical crises and problems. And the medications can help. Sometimes they just don't work, and you might need some other external, better technology to do something that's really helpful for patients. So in a lot of ways, it was an advancement, but because of stigma and other things, ECT still has sort of this ugly image, and even that carries over even into today. Now, in the 1940s, the other thing I like to do is try to provide some history for everybody so they can understand where psychiatric treatments were developed and the sort of the time frame with which these things were being used. So if we go back in the 1940s, we're actually kind of lucky these days when we're talking about treatment for depression, psychosis, and for bipolar illness. We have a lot of med choices. We have we have better psychotherapies. We have a lot of things at our disposal that people did not have, in the mid-century, in the mid-last century. People were using things like insulin coma, sleep therapy, high-dose medications just to try to keep people sedated, this camphor medication to try to induce seizures. All these things kind of fell in disuse. And so we never had antipsychotic agents. There wasn't really antidepressant agents. Lithium was one of the mainstays for bipolar treatment. Wasn't really started to be used until the 40s or 50s. medications like the antipsychotic agents for schizophrenia illnesses. That wasn't really invented and discovered until the mid-50s, and antidepressants, you know, came about more in the 1960s, and so a lot of things were developing in those decades. And in a lot of ways, the only thing you had at your disposal was some of these older things and ECT. But with the advent of a lot of different medications in the 1960s and 70s, ECT tended to decline, but ECT never really went away in the 70s because it still was very helpful for depression and other psychiatric conditions. So, and then the estimate, I think, is, you know, we don't really have great estimates on how many people are getting treated with ECT, you know, right now. About the only data that I can lean on is some older data from the 1990s, where there was an estimate of maybe 100,000 or so people were being treated with ECT. So some other key points about ECT is that ECT is the most effective treatment for depression, and there's not really a lot of argument against that per se. Again, there's side effects, there's other issues in play, but when you're talking about getting people all the way better and getting them into remission, ECT tends to be the treatment that will do that. And what we're talking about when we talk about remission is when we're doing these depression rating scores and things like that, we're trying to keep those symptoms at the lowest level they can be. So what we talk about is like quote unquote single digits on these rating scales. And when a person's in single digits or zero, if you know, you always want your depression score to be zero if you can, and that's going to be remission or single digits. Medications, you know, a lot of medication trials, if you look at a lot of medication trials for depression, it tends to be, you know, the FDA will approve a drug for a 50% drop in your scores. So if your score is 30 and your antidepressant cuts you down to 15, that's still moderately depressed. And so ECT, on the other hand, would have a better shot at driving your score from not 30 or 15, but more like 5, 6, 7 range and be in remission. So the other thing I'll try to touch on, you know, soon is about how we're trying to continue to improve ECT and how we use it and how we can try to minimize side effects and so forth. But there is just a lot of research that's still going on even with ECT, and it's not going to go away because of this sort of issue of how well it works. Some of the questions that remained are like how we, can we combine it with medications? Can we, you know, what kind of things can we do to maximize benefit with maintenance or tapers? And actually how the electrical stimulation works. So I mentioned this. This is just another brief overview of what the two main types of two types of stimulation that we might do for a patient. And so when we're talking about unilateral, this is where we're stimulating one side of the brain to get the seizure started, and then the seizure will cross over to both sides of the brain, and the brain has a period of excitement, and like I said, for 20 to 60 seconds typically. And then the patient slowly wakes up and the treatment's over in about 5 or 10 minutes. Or we do bilateral treatments, which is maybe reserved for, you know, very severe illness, but it's a way of getting the seizure started by stimulating both sides of the brain. And the major difference is that when you stimulate the right side of the brain, you avoid directly stimulating the left side of the brain, where there's a lot of your memory function. So for right-handed people, 90% of the time, a lot of memory function is on this left side of the brain, and so we avoid stimulating that area directly. And that's how we're trying to save on the memory side effects. Okay, and then I'll just briefly cover a couple things about the electrical stimulation and things that we're trying to do to. And if this gets too sciencey or too much, too much in the way of reviewing physics for you, just let me know. But I'll try to keep it as simple as I can. And then we'll talk just a touch on maintenance ECT issues and then medications and ECT. So the way the machine, the way our ECT devices work, and the way they've been working for the last number of decades is not like this, which is how your electricity flows out of your outlets. So if you plug in your toaster or what have you, your any appliance, there's sort of like a constant wave or a river of electrons that are flowing. And the brain doesn't really work like that. So the brain cells like to send a charge down the length of the brain cell, and then it likes to reset. It likes to pause, and then it likes to reset, and then it likes to fire again. And it's happening very fast, but it still likes a brief period of a pause. And so much older machines, have this, from the decades past, from the 60s and so forth, have this very, what we call an inefficient way of stimulating the brain, whereas modern machines from the last number of decades produce this, what we call a brief pulse. And so we're sending little pulses into the brain, trying to, stimulate the brain in a way that it likes to naturally fire and discharge and then reset. And it's this pulsing style of electrical activity that, like I said, can get the seizure going efficiently. And the way that we tend to, the way we manipulate the stimulation these days is how long these pulses are. And so even though ECT is 80 years old, there's a lot of research going on in the last decade where we're trying to, drop the size of these little pulses and drop the frequency and how many pulses you receive, and trying to keep them at the lowest level. So we're trying to be really efficient the way the brain wants to be, essentially tickled a little bit so it can get into a big surge of electrical activity. We're still trying to manipulate these things. So this is just by way of showing you that, even in 80 years later, we're still trying to manipulate things to make the treatment safer and better for everybody. So, like I said, it's kind of like tickling or tapping on the brain cells, trying to get them to fire up in this pulsing manner. And the way what we call these briefer and briefer pulses, we're starting to call them ultra brief pulses. So let's talk a little bit about maintenance treatments and some key points about maintenance ECT and things that we're doing today. What we're doing with the treatments is, or some key points here, is that the type of patients that tend to have ECT with us, they have really resistant depression. And so even if ECT works well for folks, they still have a high chance of a relapse within 6 to 12 months. And it's the nature of how hard it is to treat their depression, how resistant it may be to medications. And this period of, just a few weeks to a few months after ECT is real critical in when somebody may relapse. And so we know that somewhere between, 35-40% up to 50% of people could have a relapse in this short period of time, even if ECT does well. So ECT is not a cure. It might be the best treatment to break a cycle of depression, but it's still not a cure. And so how do we manage that? Well, we might, like I mentioned before, do a continuation course where we do a quick taper during that early period right after ECT, or for some people we might extend that all the way out into 6 months or longer if somebody's had a lot of relapses over time. So so it is, it's important to, again, to have some, I think in our field is to have somebody that's skilled in knowing where to, when to employ these different strategies. And we tend to be, since we are monitoring symptoms a lot and we're tracking how these moods are going up and down, we can be more, we can react to what's happening, a lot of times prevent a really severe relapse. So sometimes we can get in there and do a reset before the symptoms really take hold and really cause a lot of dysfunction for patients. So, and the big thing about the maintenance type of ECT or continuation ECT is that it extends duration between relapses and it can really reduce hospitalizations. So here's what we tend to do. I tend to be use my best common sense as well as how the patients are doing, and we devise a schedule based on how symptoms are responding to the treatment, and we're flexible to what we're doing with the treatment taper. And again, we're also monitoring, you know, the memory side effects as well. And we get all input from family and family as well to make sure we know how patients are tolerating the treatments and how they're responding. So sometimes these depression rating scales, they're great and they're helpful, but sometimes they're not as good as somebody saying, hey, you know what, my mom is now, you know, doing chores around the house and vacuuming and doing the thing, you know, so she really wants to clean the closets and vacuum, and that's, you know, that's how we know she's doing well. And so we take all that data in mind as patients go through ECT. So what about medications briefly after ECT or with ECT? So what class of medication you take after ECT has some benefit, and we typically may choose older medications that patients haven't, you know, tried yet, because a lot of them work differently, and they may actually just work better after ECT. One common thing that we tend to do based on the data is to use low-dose lithium, which tends to be used for bipolar illness and mania prevention, but it also has mild antidepressant properties, and we also combine that after ECT. So the one thing we don't know, and there's some current data to suggest that, you know, maybe you could speed response a little bit with ECT and a medication such as venlafaxine, which is Effexor, but we're not quite sure if, you know, there's more studies that need to be replicated to really understand if you can actually speed response with adding on medications like that. So, all right, so just to, you know, quick conclusions before we will break into our discussion. You know, when we do ECT, you don't want to just do it part way. ECT care can be really varied in different centers. And so what happens is that, you know, patients, and sometimes, you know, there's undue influence sometimes with insurance, you know, companies, or there's a, you know, program that ECT program that may not provide outpatient treatments, and patients may come out of the hospital after 6 treatments and say, well, ECT didn't work for me. Well, were you better? Well, I started to feel better, but then they discharged me, you know, that kind of thing. And that place doesn't provide outpatient treatments. And so I'll never know if ECT was going to work for them or not, because it sounded like it started to, but because of some limitations for all kinds of various reasons, they may not get a completed course. And so the critical thing for anybody, you know, even thinking about ECT, is to really understand, you know, how are you tracking my depression as I go through, you know, ECT? How are my memory side effects being tracked as well? But the big, you know, one big thing is that depression is really a toxic state. So I mentioned that the stress hormones get out of whack. Your brain, you're not sleeping. You might be agitated. You might be, you know, worrying and pacing, and all these things are happening. And your body's not getting good sleep and rest, and all these things are happening. And it's just not a good state for the brain to be in. And when meds fail, you know, ECT might be one of the best things to break that horrible cycle. There's a lot of things going on with augmenting with ECT, and I mentioned a few of those. And these are just a couple classes of antidepressants that we tend to think about. So there is the serotonin and norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor type agents. There's older drugs like tricyclic antidepressants. Monoamine oxidase inhibitor agents are also another one that we might suggest for patients and their doctors to think about. And we do tend to use quite a bit of low-dose lithium as a helper agent. On some occasion, there are some of these very low-dose, what we call atypical antipsychotics, that have antidepressant effects that might help reduce some of the depression symptoms as well. So in conclusion, so that's my conclusion, but I just wanted to show people too our new ECT space that was just opened up in July. And we had, our program has grown, you know, the need to provide good ECT care has grown over time. And I've been at the university for about 20 years. And our program, especially in the last 6 or 8 years, has really grown to the point where, and the hospital has grown as well as far as, you know, the need for operating room space and other surgery space that we essentially outgrew our space. And so this is our new area with a big waiting room here, and it has a really comfortable setting where patients can come prepared. This is the pre-op area. This is the treatment room here with our ECT devices here. And then this is a big anesthesia machine that's in the treatment room. And then patients, you know, after the 10-minute procedure, we have our own post-op area as well. So it's a brand new space that we're, you know, very excited to be in. It's a very calm environment for patients and families to be in versus being in a very busy, you know, surgery center type of area. So I think that is it, and I think it'll be Dr. Shamsuddin and I are willing and able to answer any questions today.
I'm Dr. Shamsuddin. I practice adult psychiatry and child adolescent psychiatry at the University of Michigan, and I'm part of the ECT team.
So, and like I mentioned, you know, Dr. Shamsuddin is one of our child psychiatrists, and you know, we are one of the few places, you know, definitely in the region that takes care of adolescents that might need ECT. And the way I usually phrase it is that, you know, psychiatric illness, depression, bipolar illness, psychosis, severe catatonia, which is a condition, you know, I could answer questions about, but these problems do not really care whether you're, you know, 13, 14, or whether you're 90 years old. And there may be a role for ECT in these different age groups, and you know, for that matter, you know, geriatric depression responds very well to ECT. So, shall we jump into some questions?
Yeah.
Are you ready? So, this is a general question about, like, what are some of the things that patients have told you after ECT? How has it helped them? You know, some, again, ECT, you know, the success rate can be as high as, you know, 80-85% when there's certain types of depression that are going to really respond to it. And it may not be a perfect treatment, but when it does work, it's pretty miraculous. And so they'll actually say things like that was like, you know, this has been like a miracle for me, or it saved my life. Do you have other comments about how ECT has helped them?
Yeah, I kind of like the variation in the percentage, like when we say 60 to 80% is usually because of the presentation. So when someone is just presenting with depression alone as a problem, even severe depression, that's a higher percentage of responding to ECT. The percentage start going down when there are other problems like alcohol problems, substance use problems. Sometimes there, as we always say, there's no perfect personality. Each one of us, we have our own positive and negative aspects of personality. Sometimes in certain personality types, there are these personality types, they resort to self-cutting or suicidal behavior while they are stressed. These behaviors, these are the ones that do not respond to ECT, but as a depression, their depression get better with ECT. So if it's presentation of more of depression with no other problems, substance use, it's much likely to respond to ECT. And that's what patients notice themselves.
So, any child cases and how they've responded or what they might have said, how they've done with it?
Yeah, like multiple times we are compiling our data at university and to present it for the past 15 years. I haven't been practicing for 15 years, Dr. Ghazi-Uddin, but she's traveling now. She wasn't able to join us. So many of the kids that had ECT at University of Michigan had chronic severe depression. They were in therapy for 2 years. They, on average, had like 10 medication trials, different medications. Some of them attempted up to 10 times suicide in the 12 months before ECT, which show how severe their depression was. After the ECT course, up to 80% of them went back to school, were not showing any suicidal behavior, and their depression was almost in remission. So that speaks about how it's effective for children, adolescents.
Okay, and so hopefully that answered that question. But like I said, people really do feel like at times it's they really acknowledge it's life-saving and miraculous. And I think that in some ways, when the types of patients, this is sort of going to feed into the next question, is like who might be the best candidate for ECT. So there's certain types of depression, and there's a certain type of depression called psychotic depression, when somebody is so lost in their mind, they're worried, they might have severe guilty thoughts, they might have severe physical, medical worries, they might have such guilty thoughts that they think God's punishing them, or they might be so psychotic with that depression that they're just not eating and drinking, and they're pacing, they're agitated, not sleeping for days and days. And when you see somebody respond, and when ECT does work, a typical course is 6 to 12 treatments, and that's literally two or three, within 2 or 3 weeks, you're seeing dramatic changes for somebody who might have been sick and in the hospital for weeks at a time, and may have been sick for a year or two even for some people, or longer. So, but the question about who's a good ECT candidate, there's about three or four main types of conditions that ECT is used for. So depression is one, severe major depression, bipolar mania is another condition. So when it's the flip side of depression and the mania is occurring and it's doesn't respond to medications, and ECT can help stabilize that end of the mood spectrum as well. Psychosis, such as psychosis connected with schizophrenia, certain patients may benefit from ECT. And those are the big, I would say, the big three. And then there's the other big one is catatonia. So patients who, whether it's a neurologic disease or whether it's a psychiatric disease, they may slip into a catatonic state where they're not responding, they're mute, their muscles might get really stiff and rigid. It's as if their brain is really stuck on and they won't, but then they become extremely negative and withdrawn inside themselves, so much so that they're not eating, drinking. And when you're that stiff and rigid, lying in bed and negative, you start to break down muscle, and that becomes a problem for your kidneys to flush the waste from this breakdown of muscle. And it becomes a really big crisis with dehydration and blood pressure problems, and all kinds of medical problems can happen with catatonia at its most extreme end. And so that type of condition, especially when they're in the hospital setting, we see a fair amount of catatonia in the hospital due to medical problems or neurologic problems, and especially psychiatric problems. That type of condition responds very well to ECT. And like I mentioned too, like that form of severe major depression where there's that type of psychosis that where there's severe worries about physical health and guilty thoughts. And sometimes another common theme that plays out with psychotic depression is what we call delusions of poverty. And so patients might have this extreme worry, like, they might be very wealthy or they might be very secure financially, but they might actually have extreme worries that I'm going to go broke, or who's going to pay for this? Is Medicare going to pay for this insurance, this hospitalization, this ECT, or I just sold one of my four houses, and I'm now going to go broke. These are the kinds of quotes that I'll get from patients because they're so worried about everything. But a lot of the depression worries, they worry they're going to be on the street, they're going to be broke, and financially in ruin. And so that's another one of those bad worries that happens with certain depression episodes. Anything else you want to say about any other good candidates?
No, basically that's the same. For teenagers, we don't get the worries, I think, more in the geriatric population. Right. Teenager, more of the depression and the catatonia, patients with the mental retardations, developmental delays, autism, are at high risk of developing catatonia. That's something common for ECT in this age group.
Okay. These are the ones. And then what are some of the barriers for ECT being more widely used? I think some of it's stigma. Yeah, you know, I helped with so I think that's still a big issue is stigma about it. I think access is another barrier because, you know, it's not, you know, when you look at the number of psychiatry doctors that actually do ECT, there's probably only about 5 or 10% of us psychiatry doctors that do brain stimulation or ECT types of treatment for patients. And so if you're up north, you know, we get referrals from up north, you know, you may have very limited access. So I can just tell you there's certain places up north where patients, you know, are being referred because, you know, the doctor may be only, you know, there may be only one doctor that does ECT and they can't consistently do a full course of treatments for patients. So access, stigma.
Legal aspects.
What's that?
Legal aspects for kids. So in some states, it's prohibited to have ECT for teenagers. Other states, like they limit the number. Like in Illinois, Illinois allow only 6 sessions of ECT. So, which is raised the question: what's the point? Like, if they need 8 or 10, so you stop at 6. So that's another aspect.
So over the decades, we've had patients from all, you know, from especially young patients. There's a lot of barriers, legal barriers, state law barriers in California, Texas, Minnesota, and you know we've hosted kids from Texas that are under 16. So you can have ECT, but you have to be at least 16. But like I mentioned, if you're severely ill, depressed, psychotic, you have psychosis or something, you may not be able to get treatment in Texas. And so we had you know, going back to one of the questions about, you know, what do people tell, you know, say about ECT, you know, one of the most memorable cases that I had with that was in the adolescent realm was a young girl who was about 12 or 13, and she had very severe bipolar condition with psychosis, and she had some of these catatonia features, and was mute and was having a lot of struggles, and she came from Texas because there was, you know, and she had been, you know, unfortunately given lots of medications which caused bad reactions in these, you know, in some kids and so forth. And when we were done with her treatment, she was really good to go, and she was from the Dallas area, and she wanted to get the heck out of the hospital. And so on her last treatment, I said, "Well, how are you doing?" And she goes, "I'm doing great." And I go, "Well, what are you going to do when you get out of here?" "Well, I got to hurry up and get home so I can, you know, get to, you know, Six Flags over Texas so I can, you know, get the amusement park before school starts." It was in August, and so she had to hustle home, you know, to get back, you know, to get out and do something fun. So. But like I said, access is access, and some of these legal barriers are some of the other things. Just a quick question about: does family input require a medical release signed by the patient? Is there any genetic test that can predict patient response to lithium per se? So there's a couple questions there. As far as the lithium question, I don't know of any genetic tests right now that would predict response for that particular agent. For family input, usually we're aligning with patients and families when we do treatment when we do ECT. So, you know, sometimes there you might need a medical release, but quite often we're just working side by side with families, and we're not having to sign. You know, families can always tell us whatever they want. We sometimes if the patient says we don't want, you know, this particular family member involved, we may not be able to release or tell, you know, say anything about how the patient's doing, but patients' families can always, you know, they can always tell doctors or social workers anything they want if the doctor will listen.
For adolescents, we don't worry about that aspect because usually the parents are the guardians who have to sign the paperwork, and we have always to get their input.
Okay. Let's see. So this is just a little bit about the treatment. So somebody asked me if I've ever experienced a treatment, and I would say no, I have not experienced the treatment myself. Thankfully, I have not had to go that route. But I would say that I wouldn't hesitate, though. You know, especially if I was as sick as some of our patients are, and how they've been through the ringer with medication trials. I have no compunctions about,
I would say I recommended it to family members, family members.
So patients do ask that too. Would you have your mom or dad or, one of your family members treated? And I would say yes. Is in the post-ECT treatment time, what is the optimal recovery time post-ECT for patient release to go home? So typically, for our outpatients, the treatment itself is about 10, 15 minutes in the treatment room, you start to wake up, and then you go to the recovery area, and it could be about 30 minutes to 60 minutes is a typical kind of time frame before a person's, waking up from the anesthesia and is having something to eat or drink and getting, getting changed into clothes and getting ready to go home. Are patients outside U of M clinics routinely counseled about their need for potentially retreatment and maintenance? So, I definitely make that part of my discussion and education process. Like I said, I spend a lot of time doing that. I can't vouch for what other clinicians may do or say. I know some doctors in the area, routinely do some maintenance treatments and things like that. And so I would hope that they were, educating them about it. So.
What's the youngest patient you've had that had received ECT? I think the youngest was 14.
You've treated, right?
So, yes.
Okay.
At U of M. Usually it is for teenagers. We don't use it. I haven't come across a case for a child.
We haven't had that many young children, but the young girl from Texas was a 11 and a half or 12. She might have been maybe next to the youngest. Had somebody else who was extremely suicidal and depressed, young girl who was about 10. And long ago, about 10, 15 years ago, there was a educational show on ECT on the Discovery Channel, and they actually featured at the University of Iowa a young girl who was about 8 or so, and she had this severe catatonia picture where there was psychosis and there was this, she was stiff and rigid like a board. She wasn't eating and drinking at all, and they interviewed her as a young adolescent / or late adolescent, young girl going off to college. And they showed her as she was going through the treatment, or what she looked like before the treatment, and then they interviewed her years later after she had gone through treatment and was essentially a normal young lady going off to college. So there's no real set age like we talked about. So anything else you want to add on that?
I guess that's it. Want to talk about MS?
So we could mention that. So this question's about, are there any other treatments, existing or emerging treatments for depression that are similar to ECT? So nothing exactly like ECT, but we do have transcranial magnetic stimulation, which is a little bit different, where you're stimulating or just one part of the brain that's a very superficial, very focal spot that we're trying to treat on this left part of your brain, on the left frontal lobe of your brain. It's called transcranial magnetic stimulation. And that's been approved since about 2008. And insurance companies are now starting to pay for it, including Medicare. Or at least there's some coverage for it. It may not be complete with Medicare. And that's a treatment we do offer that at our outpatient clinic. And that's a treatment that's well tolerated. It's as if you're sitting in a dental chair and you're having this device, with some tapping sensations for about 5 seconds. It turns off for 30 seconds and then it taps again on your scalp for 5 seconds, and it cycles like that for about 30 minutes or so. and it activates or excites this area underneath your scalp here in your frontal lobe there that has some depression circuit connections and helps activate that area. So that's an area of clinical care that we provide at U of M. There's been some research with vagus nerve stimulation, which is another stimulation where there's a pacemaker in your, that sits here in your chest, and it activates a nerve in your neck called the vagus nerve and sends impulses back up into your brain. And so VNS is another device that's used for depression, but it's not used very much because insurance companies don't use it or pay for it. It's not that strong of an antidepressant. It does work for some people, but it's not that strong, and we don't have that many patients that we actually track or follow or refer for surgery. VNS helps with seizure problems, and that's how it originally got started because it helps reduce seizures. That's in that vagus nerve stimulation. And then we did participate in a deep brain stimulation protocol a couple years ago, and I was Dr. Shamstein and I were talking about that, where the study protocol did not have enough evidence early in the study to push forward with a bigger study to show good, really solid antidepressant effect. But there's a number of smaller studies where deep brain stimulation is actually using probes that actually are surgically implanted in your brain, and it's much more invasive than ECT for sure. But there's certain brain targets that neurosurgeons and neurologists have used for Parkinson's, tremor problems, and OCD problems and depression. But as of right now, it's not indicated, and you can't get implanted just for depression problems. So what else you got?
These are mainly limited for adults. I have no training in these techniques, TMS or vagal nerve stimulation. I know my understanding for TMS, there's a study still for adolescents, but I'm not sure about the results.
Okay. So this one is about, are there any, that was that one. And then, let's see here. Oh yeah, this is a quick one about the convulsion with ECT. So the brain seizure with ECT, is it similar to a grand mal seizure or fit? The answer is that it's much different. And when you have a grand mal seizure, you might have a full body convulsion, but it may be just the superficial parts of the brain that are activated. But with the ECT seizure, we're trying to recruit and get as many neurons or brain cells activated and stimulated. And so there's something different about the ECT that we may be stimulating deeper parts of the brain that are controlling mood, appetite, and these things that we talked about, like the stress hormones, that make it different than just a seizure disorder situation where you might be prone to having grand mal seizures.
I would add that in ECT, because of the anesthesia, they are making sure that the patient is oxygenated through the whole procedure. That makes it safer. Because in grand mal seizure, many times the patients stop breathing. And if it's going for 30 seconds, 1 minute, longer, few minutes, through that time, the patient is not breathing. They are not getting oxygen to their brain. That has a negative impact on the brain. But in ECT, we are making sure that through the whole procedure, the patient is getting oxygen.
Okay. And so this one is asking about the physiologic effects of, say, insulin coma. Let's see here. So with insulin coma, so that was one of these older treatments from the 30s and 40s. And there was actually, the issue with insulin coma, when you drop your blood sugar with insulin, you actually can induce a seizure. And so originally, way back when, decades ago, insulin coma was not, the goal was not to actually induce a seizure. So it wasn't supposed to be a seizure treatment. There was some other theory that clinicians had way back when that escapes me right off the top of my head. But
But there was some sort of either neurotransmitter theory or other neurologic theory that how insulin, by dropping your blood sugar, might help your mood or help your psychiatric issue. But so that treatment, nobody does insulin coma, and that's fallen off by the wayside long ago. And then this is talking about ECT and the use of volts versus the brain working on millivolts, and how much electricity are we, zipping through that conductor, and does that cause brain damage? So, there's been many studies looking at, brain imaging and looking at brain structure, things like that, and nobody's really been able to show that ECT causes brain damage. But the actual electrical output, we tend not to measure things like in volts, but it would be kind of a physics lesson to talk about the charge, the electrical charge that we're using. But the current that we use is really, 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 really low current. And so when you see like somebody being defibrillated or something, it's like we clear, get away, that you're this stimulation, this electrical activity might fly around the room and shock everybody in the room if you touch somebody too close or whatever. But it's not like that. We can touch the bed. We can touch the patient and nothing bad's going to happen. So the current itself is really, really it's milliamps and not amps, that kind of thing. And the charge that we use is really pretty low. So use in schizophrenia and asking a little bit about number of patients, success rates maybe, and how is it different from depression. Like I mentioned, patients with schizophrenia, they can be resistant to medications as well. Patients who have schizophrenia may have what we call negative symptoms, where they're very withdrawn, they're amotivated. They don't have, their motivation is very low. And so negative symptoms that kind of mimic depression if they're negative symptoms of schizophrenia tend not to respond very well to ECT. On the other hand, patients with schizophrenia might have severe hallucinations, might have severe psychosis, paranoia, and we call those the positive symptoms. And on the positive symptoms, in the right situation, ECT can be helpful. There's some older data to support that medications with ECT might be a really good combination to try to treat that resistant psychosis. Patients who have catatonia and psychosis, they can respond to ECT. But like I said, it tends to be the patients that might have more of the positive symptoms. I've been at the university for 20 some years, and Northville was a state hospital that was a very large state hospital that eventually closed in the early 2000s. But we would tend to get a few patients a year back in those days where the patient may be intolerant of medications or have bad reactions to medications, but yet they're still not eating and drinking. Their psychosis or paranoia may be so bad that they're not functioning well. And in that situation, you might take a shot at that condition with ECT. And so when I looked at some of these older studies, kind of like what we use for resistant schizophrenia, which is clozapine, which is an antipsychotic agent, and that when people are resistant to a lot of antipsychotic agents, you might try clozapine, and clozapine might capture or help 40% of those really resistant patients. ECT is probably in that range too, in my experience, especially with medications, you might be able to really put a dent in the psychosis and the symptoms of schizophrenia. I do think it's probably underutilized, and some of the barriers with patients with psychosis or schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorder. When a patient's in the throes of a bad episode, they're not going to want treatment of any kind. They may lack insight, and then you may need to have guardianship or other things involved to try to get the ECT done, or it has to be like a medical emergency sometimes. So there's legal barriers, but also there's just not there's fewer and fewer places with the community mental health. Sometimes we have patients that are in the, you know, in the community mental health system that get referred in, you know, for treatment, but it tends to be a rare situation right now.
Schizophrenia is a disorder of adulthood in typical age of onsets for males. It's early 20s. For females, it is late 20s and again in the 40s. So for children and adolescents, the rate of schizophrenia is like 1 in 10,000. It's very rare. Psychotic symptoms in teenager and children occur more in context of mood disorders, whether depression or bipolar disorder, or even in context of trauma. So schizophrenia, this question doesn't apply to that group.
Okay, and so somebody's asking about Depakote versus inducing seizures. So that says, oh yes, this is the irony. This is a good one. So this is one of those paradoxical things, or these things that, you know, kind of don't make sense with ECT, and I'll explain this one. So they're asking about, like, we use a lot of mood stabilizer agents or anticonvulsants to treat mania and bipolar illness. Classic things are like Depakote, Lamictal, or Tegretol, you know, classically in the past too. Other anticonvulsants are used for mania. And so why would inducing a seizure help with mania? And it's a good question. We don't know the answer. We don't exactly know how ECT works. We have a number of biologic effects that it does have. And one of the interesting things I didn't mention was that it actually is, ECT is actually anticonvulsant. And so the more treatments that a person gets, what we call the seizure threshold starts to rise, and the shorter the seizures become. And there's something about when we get the brain really excited, it also tries to shut itself off. And so it's an excited state that the brain's in, but then the brain says, wait a second, we should shut this down after a period of time. And the brain kind of goes into a quiet mode, especially right after the treatment. And we can actually see that quiet mode happen right after ECT. And so that's not a normal brain activity, like when you're awake, walking around, thinking about things. So the bottom line, though, is that the ECT actually isn't, ECT is an anticonvulsant, so to speak. So do you ever recommend ECT for moderate chronic depression? I would say, in the right situation, I would say it doesn't hurt to talk about and look into. When you're thinking about predictors of response with ECT, better if the duration of the illness is not extremely long, or the medication failures are not extremely many. So because of this toxic state, I tend to worry about, why are people so resistant, in today's psychiatric practice? Why are patients resistant? One thought might be that, a person is on medications over many, many years, and they're kind of partially better, but they've never got fully back into remission. And so that's always a risk if you don't hit remission, that you might not, you might not respond to the next medication and so forth, and then it becomes this cycle over many years. So again, when you kind of look at predictors of response, duration of illness and medication failures tend to be more of a negative predictor of response. When I consult with patients, I think, sometimes it's worthwhile talking about, because sometimes patients have been really depressed for a long, long time. And even if your chances, the chances are, 85% for the patient who's been really anxious and depressed and agitated for 6 months, if that number drops, 60 or 50%, it's still 50-50 shot, for a lot of patients, and so we have to kind of weigh the pros and cons out with patients and have that kind of discussion. And so in the right situation, I do often try the ECT, because especially if it's gotten worse over time too, if that's a factor, then you might be able to address the worst part of the depression. and hopefully, you know, generate a decent response. So not everybody gets in remission, but, you know, a lot of patients, we can put a big dent in the depression and get a good response. So, what about the long-term negative effects of after ECT use? Have you come across anything like that? I know that you're with the child and adolescents, data we're looking at.
So I would say no, and it could be because we are kind of a referral center. It's not necessarily all the patients are our own patients that we keep following with them over time. Many times we have patients that come from different area of Michigan or from different states. We do the acute course, a little bit of the maintenance course, and then we send them back to their primary psychiatrist. Though we've been consulted for case with the patients who came and who said, like, as you saw earlier in the presentation, that their memory was never back to normal. I've seen one or two cases like this, and that wasn't their main concern about ECT. But they were still willing to consider ECT because they thought, like, it helped them in the past getting out of their depression. And here, a part of the discussion would be, okay, if they had the bilateral ECT in the past, maybe going with the unilateral ECT this time.
So, I mean, as far as, long-term negative effects, I would say it's, it'd be, like I mentioned, kind of rare that patients might report some sort of, prominent remote memory issue. And again, I'm not going to say that somebody can't have some sort of remote problem, especially if they've had lots of treatments or if their illness is such that it's been very severe over years and they've required, a lot of different courses. And that is part of the risk benefit. And so I have one patient that's probably, over, 4 decades has probably had, 6 or 7 courses of treatments and tends to do well afterwards. But she may, say that especially around the time of those treatment courses that she had some memory deficits in those time frames. But overall, we've had, the typical scenario is that patients kind of, from all walks of life, nurses, engineers, doctors, lawyers, actuaries, a lot of different, folks out there, move on and get on with their lives after ECT. So as far as treating different folks, from different, socioeconomic scales, can we treat people from different socioeconomic levels? Sure, we do all the time. For us, there's no discrimination on who gets, just like with age, there's no discrimination on who may be depressed. And so we try our best to take care of anybody that needs the treatment. What about psychotherapy? Let's see here. So what about psychotherapy from ECT or from treatment? I'm trying to see. But I think with psychotherapy, we do, when you're getting ECT, I would say it's hard to really engage in therapy. So you have to kind of get the course done first, and then what we do is try to get patients connected with their therapist and or with make sure the medications are optimized and make sure that they get good help for psychotherapy as well, because when you're better, sometimes there's a lot of there's a lot of social things going on, there's still a lot of family stress, and so kind of a pivotal time is when patients are doing better in the hospital, but yet we discharge them to finish their ACT course, but yet and there's still all this distress at home with marital issues or whatever it might be, work issues, work crises and other things. So we try to make sure people get connected with psychotherapy, but during the acute phase, it's important to try to just focus on getting through that part. And we can't even refer patients to partial hospitalization on the outpatient basis when they're getting ECT, because the ECT is kind of an intense, you know, time to, you know, of treatment. But I would say that once people do get better, then for sure, when your mood is better, you can better engage in therapy. So somebody's asking about TMS and about memory issues too. So it's just, you know, it is one of those, you know, TMS is a potential, you know, alternative, you know, with respect to, you know, not being as invasive or having less memory side effects. And so situation with TMS is that it still may not be as solidly good, you know, for depression as far as outcomes go, but somewhere in that early zone of resistance, TMS can be helpful for, you know, for a lot of patients. So just a couple questions. You know, can ECT make depression worse? I would say typically not. I would say that sometimes people have kind of, they might have a little bit of a rocky course through ECT. They might show some initial response and there's a dip. And, you know, you have to be, you know, sometimes patient. So sometimes there is these ups and downs that might happen with ECT, but typically ECT doesn't make depression worse. The one thing that does happen, though, in the clinical practice with ECT is that when we're monitoring patients during ECT, as you get more and more treatments, you might have more and more memory side effects. And when you have memory side effects, if you're an anxious person, you might have a lot of, you know, might have a lot of anxiety about that. You might feel like you're off, or it could make you feel in some ways depressed. But if we're tracking the memory side effects very closely, then what we might do is taper off or back off or take a pause and let a person, you know, have some period of clearing, and that sometimes will help, you know, remedy that problem. But, you know, especially once you're out from depression, you know, out from the treatment, whether it worked or didn't work, it tends not to make depression worse, but it might appear that way sometimes for some people when they're going through the full course. Do treatments continue for life? You know, our goal is not to have them continue for life. You know, we do have patients that, you know, that may need it for life, especially in you know, some geriatric patients that we've had over time where the illness just keeps coming back. At University of Michigan, too, we have a lot of patients that might have, you know, a combination of problems. They might have a neurologic illness like Parkinson's disease, which eventually does lead to, you know, potential dementia problems and movement problems and depression problems, has all those things in play. And we may treat as long as that we think the treatment is doing something positive for them. And ECT might even, you know, help with Parkinson's a little bit too, at least temporarily. It can help with the Parkinson's symptoms too. So there's all these different things that could happen, but typically our goal is not to do it for life, right? And we're always trying, you know, with outpatient doctors and with our team, we're always trying to figure out ways to taper off the treatments. Can it help with attention and focus? Does ECT help with attention and focus? To the extent that it treats depression and other memory problems or memory problems associated with mood or psychosis problems, the answer would be yes. Does it help with ADHD or things like that? No, it wouldn't really help with those kinds of problems. What else? For PTSD, is it useful for PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder? Like Dr. Shamsuddin mentioned, you know, I think when there's depression in play with some of these conditions, like anxiety disorder issues, the depression is the big focus. And so we've had patients who have had, you know, they might have PTSD problems, they might have severe OCD problems, obsessive compulsive disorder problems, to the point where the OCD symptoms are just extremely paralyzing, but in the mix is a really bad depression. And occasionally, you know, ECT might really help with that depression, and then the OCD symptoms and things might be a little bit better because the depression is not in the way. So, okay, so here's a question. So, like, this might be a question about, is there anything that might preclude you from starting ECT or doing ECT? What we tend to say is that there's no absolute contraindications to doing ECT. So we can do, we can do patients who are, have had many medical problems before, heart attacks, other things that, you have to be cautious, of course, and make sure that their medical problems have been stabilized. But patients who have had heart problems, pacemakers, automatic defibrillators on board, patients who have had, different types of strokes or brain injury, head injuries, So with ECT, what we're, sometimes what we try to do is find some target symptoms and target problem. And so the brain, and these problems come in so many varied forms that there's, on occasion, you might have a bad depression that's due to a head injury or something like that. And when it's bad enough and when there's suicidal thinking, such severe depression that a person's not functioning well and meds aren't working. And at some point, ECT, could be considered. Stroke patients, we've had patients with a number of, types of, like I said, brain injuries, including strokes or other things that might be worthwhile at least discussing. So, well, I hopefully this was informative for everybody. If anybody wants to ask us questions later, thanks.